Hi, everybody. I'm Dre Harrison. Welcome to episode 553 of Motorsport 101. It kind of makes me a little bit sad that we haven't got two comedic intros in a week back to back. But once again, I didn't really feel like it was an appropriate time for that. I'm not stupid. I'm not ignorant to the larger world. We're recording this on November the 6th, the day after Election Day.
Something happened on Election Day, Dre.
Nothing good.
Nothing.
And I make no bones about it. I'm a Brit. I'm the only Brit on this show on a regular basis. I'm surrounded by two fine American people. And I know that our largest audience is American. And I've taken a lot of pride over the last... And this was meant to be a happy celebration, because this was meant to be the 10th anniversary of this show. We've been doing this for 10 years now, in some way, shape, or form.
Damn, that's crazy.
And I want to take a few minutes out at the top of the show to just remind people that I know that times are hard. You don't need me to tell you that. I know a lot of people are scared, are hurt, are sad, are angry at how the election result turned out. I am one of those people. I'm a Brit. I had 14 years straight of Conservative Party rule, and when we were just as frustrated the way it's turned out over here as well. We're not far behind the Americans in every sense.
We got it from you, Dad.
Understandable. And I just want... And I really wanted to push hard with these two recordings tonight, because I'm very fortunate to have this show. I'm very fortunate that it's been able to parlay me into working in the industry that I've always dreamed of wanting to work in. This show has opened so many doors for not just me, but for so many other people. I'm immensely proud of the community. It's not a very large one, but it's a community nonetheless that we've been able to pull together for the last 10 years of like-minded, sometimes socially awkward misfits that all have a common love for motorsport, sport in general, and a love for people and a love for each other. And a part of me didn't want to do this tonight, but as, I guess, editor, lead writer, lead editor, whatever you want to call me, of this little club.
The boss of Motorsport 101, basically. This is your thing.
It is my thing, and I take an immense amount of pride in that thing. So much so that I've turned down work because of this thing. Because if M101 isn't coming with me, then it's not worth doing, quite frankly. I just wanted to say in front of everybody here that this is your safe space. This can be your escape from the nastiness of the real world. I don't claim to think that we're anything special in the grand scheme of things, but I sincerely hope, and I believe I've got a genuine duty of care to the Motorsport 101 audience and community and the people around us, that if we can be a mild bit of relief and entertainment and comfort from the horrible nature of the outside world, then that's enough for me. You're the best audience in the world. I'm incredibly grateful to have you. Thank you for inviting us into your homes for the last 10 years. And it's a continued honor and a privilege to be able to do this. This is a safe space. As I've always said, Motorsport 101 is a show made by people from all walks of life, for all walks of life. We are pro-diversity. We are pro-choice. We believe that motorsport should be fun and it should be for everyone. And that goes beyond motorsport as well. If you don't believe in that, if you believe that you'd rather commit a felony and publish that on your podcast and take pride in that, knock yourself out. Don't listen to this show. It's not for you.
We've made no bones.
And that's okay.
We've made no bones over the years about who we, what we believe in. And we will continue on that path. And for those of you who are out there, who are scared, I have some in my life right now. Who have had to have very difficult conversations with on this day. Continue. Live. Live with all of your might.
This is what I gotta do, man. Because like, I've experienced a lot over the last 24 hours. By the way, if we didn't say it at the top, Donald Trump has won his second term as president of the United States, as things stand. That's pretty much a done deal. We as three motorsport podcasters can't really do anything to change that by ourselves. By ourselves, we can't really change what potentially comes next in the coming months, in the coming years, however long it takes. And there are a lot of like very tough discussions that we're going to have to have as a society with our families, with our peers, etc. I don't think we can fix all this by ourselves in just a short amount of time. But with our communities, whether that's family we have that supports us or the family that we found, or our friends, or our peer groups, maybe we are just a little bit stronger. And I know this is kind of coming off the rip. I'm just like I'm going through a lot. Like the last 12 hours or so, I had to think just like, man, how do we get through this? If you have nothing to really lose or gain out of this election, that must be really free. I wish I knew that feeling, but I simply don't. And I know in the line of work that we're in, we're also going to come across like very tough conversation. I know the line of work that we're in. We cover motorsport, and we know that a lot of people are very happy about the way things down. And it's not even just like the usual retired grifters like your Danica Patricks or your self-professed smartest people in the room like Lucas Degrassi's. We know it's an overwhelming conservative audience of people who take part and participate. Sometimes, especially in my case, it's going to mean I have to go step into a press space or a garage and have to look these people in the eye and just kind of put that out of my mind as much as I really, really, really don't want to. And then surely someone will say, well, why do we like this? Why are we contributing to feed this sport that doesn't do anything to better the environment? In fact, it makes it worse and is populated by some of the worst people on planet Earth. Why do we do this, Trey?
Because we love cars. We love motorsport. We love the thrill of the chase. We love the vroom vroom. And it's brought us all together. And it's a powerful thing, the power of community. And as corny and as cringy and as friendship speech as it sounds, some of the greatest people of my life I've met through motorsport. People that I can genuinely say are friends for life. People that at one point I thought was the love of my life came through motorsport. I've lived a life, man. I'm only 32 years of age. I've been doing this for 13 years on a semi-professional level. And it's changed my life in so many unimaginable ways. Yeah, we're well aware deep down that we know that there's a lot of awful shit that comes of our motorsport politically. Sports and politics are joined at the hip. We've said it so many times on this show. We've seen so many walking examples and case studies of that have come through in the last 10 years we've been covering it on this show.
And trust us, our shit is niche compared to like football, American football, basketball.
Oh yeah.
Olympics, you name it.
Just a drop in the bucket. Lewis Hamilton leading a Black Lives Matter campaign was the first tip on the iceberg we ever had. We've come a long way from my ex-girlfriend was a trained assassin in the first 10 episodes of our own existence. And yet, here we are, 10 years later. I'd like to think the world's a better place. It probably isn't. But we still have each other. And that is something that I hold and cherish very dearly right now.
Yeah.
So let's Absolutely. Talk some motorsport because that's what we're all here to do. And like I said, if it pauses and numbs a little bit of the sting for just an hour or so, I'd like to think that's a net positive.
Absolutely, man. And boy, did we have quite the Brazilian Grand Prix this past Sunday. By the way, if we miss it at the top, we're Motorsport 101. That was Trey Harrison. I'm RJ O'Connell. another American in the room is Cam Buck.
All right.
Places you can find us, motorsport101.com, youtube.com/motorsport101, Facebook, Instagram.
Elon Musk's treasonous,
Blue Sky.
Treasonous business investment.
Not that he'd ever look, man, we probably also got to like think about how we consume social media in this day and age.
No kidding.
That's, again, that's a conversation for another time, man. But motorsport101.com has all of our podcasts, all of our written material, all the places you can find us, learn about us, etc., etc. Dre, let's talk about the Brazilian Grand Prix.
Yeah, this might be the lengthiest exposition that I've ever written to introduce a race on a podcast because, and I'll let you in on a little secret, I'm pretty confident that this DRR that I wrote as the accompaniment on our website is the longest I've ever written for a race review because this was extensive. I've been doing race reviews in some degree for better part of a decade. I cannot remember a wackier weekend than this one. Right, where do we start? Okay, we had a sprint race on Saturday morning where McLaren took a 1-2 finish despite making a complete horlicks of a driver swap to let Lando Norris win his first career sprint race.
I was not watching that race. I was out with my partner just having a good time knowing that, like, you know, we're not so sure how the next 72 hours were going to go. And, well, we know what happened there. But, yeah, 1-2 finish, Norris over Piastri. And then what happened in qualifying that afternoon?
Well, it didn't happen. It was completely rained off. It was so much standing water, so much heavy rain. Visibility was an obvious concern. They kept pushing the session back in 15-minute intervals until it got to about an hour and a half before sunset. Formula One realized, okay, well, now we're at risk of not being able to get a full session in at all, and then they decided to call it off. This has only happened, I want to say, 5 times in Formula One history in the modern day format, where qualifying was called off and then reran on Sunday morning, 7:30 a.m. local time, Sunday morning. I think it's the earliest qualifying start time ever in F1 history. So apparently the gates were open at 5:30 in the morning to get the fans in. I salute to every single member of the ground staff who was able to make that happen. That must have been a hell of an effort given the last minute turnaround, the nature of scheduling, and we're talking more about that in our next episode as well, that they were able to pull that off. But we had qualifying on Sunday morning, and then another record fell. We had 5 red flags in qualifying.
Five times red flags. Alex Albon was scratched from the race from damage that he sustained in qualifying. Only the second Williams car to crash out of qualifying. Lando Norris took pole, and Max Verstappen missed out on Q3, qualified 12th, but because he had a 5-place penalty for changing engines before the weekend, he would start 17th because he got caught out when Lance Stroll went in the wall. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah, a bit of a championship flashpoint there. Verstappen starting 17th and absolutely incensed. We'll get into why later. But Lando Norris on pole, and we're now thinking, uh-oh, Norris is probably favorite to win the world title again. This could be the chance to take a huge amount of points out of Max. Then the race happened.
Yeah, there was a strong contender that emerged in the summer who people were feeling mildly optimistic that could surge forward and take this battle. But ultimately, their challenger overperformed all predictions coming into the deciding battle and won.
Yeah.
Max Verstappen opened the can. He was 11th by lap 2, carving his way then up to 6th as the rain peaks in damn near undrivable conditions. Your leaders all stop in front of him to try and get fresh enters on the car, with the exception of Esteban Ocon, more on him in a little bit. Max stays out, and then, oh boy, it's a Williams F1 car. Oh no, it's a Williams F1 car.
Franco Colapinto can open his car coming out of the final corner, trying to catch up with the safety car view. He just hot foots it too much. And in these conditions, too much is a little bit more than you might think. He smashed in the wall, thankfully walks away, but that brings out a red flag. And that means that you can change tires for free during this red flag. It left Max Verstappen free to attack Esteban Ocon to take the lead on the race's third safety car restart. And he won comfortably by 19 seconds. And in that moment, as Verstappen lunged past Ocon to take the lead, Lando Norris slid off at the first corner, and he would eventually finish in sixth. So after Brazil, it means that Max Verstappen's championship lead is now 63 points, GR63, with a chance of clinching it at the next round in Las Vegas to kick off this third and this next and final triple header to close out the season.
Yeah, just to clarify here, the easiest maths on this, if Verstappen wins in Vegas, he's world champion. If Norris doesn't outscore Verstappen by 3 points or more, he's champion. And if Norris scores less than 4 points in Vegas, period, Max is champion.
Those are the easiest way forward is to win Nevada.
Yeah. Indeed.
Yeah. If you break it down by a required run rate, it's 21 points a weekend. A win is worth 26 at best. Good luck with that.
It's over. Call it what it is.
It's Jover, quite literally.
It's literally never been more Jover than it has been right now. It's you sound like you named the Pokemon. This was one of the best wet weather drives I have ever seen. This was a fundamental ass whooping in every capacity by Max Verstappen. And you know what? I don't care what anyone says or if anyone wants to accuse me of bias, fine. I can accept that. This championship fight needed a good old-fashioned Barney, one that was clean, one that was proper. This was starting to get quite nasty, this title feud. This was starting to get quite unsavory with the amount of talk about unsportsmanlike conducts, butt-rushing apexes, rights to reviews, and rather bitchy comments. If you all saw the press conferences on Thursday, Johnny Herbert throwing his 2 cents in the ring, Damon Hill saying that, oh, he's becoming Dick Dastardly, Max clapping back with, I'm a three-time world champion, I know what I'm doing. We needed some clarity in this fight. And then Max decided to open a can of whoop-ass and remind everybody who the best driver on the planet is.
He already had one of his finest performances in wet conditions in Brazil in 2016. This is by far and away leagues beyond that. And it's not just because he won. Although, to be fair, that did a long way reinforcing that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, in biblical conditions where it went from generic wet conditions to monsoon, debatably full wet tire conditions. He kept his head. He was laughably, visibly faster than everyone else on track. He drilled Oscar Piastri from about 6 tenths back to the point where Oscar didn't even see it coming. Clean as you like, drove around him, took off into the distance.
In the words of Alex Jakes, it wasn't even a contest.
It's like the way I describe this, and especially with the rage that Max showed after qualifying, this was going to end one of two ways. Max was going to win the race or he was going to crash in frustration. But it's like,
oh, and boy, it was the prospect of an Ocon Verstappen 1-2 restart coming off that red flag. If you know the history between those two at Interlagos specifically, you were thinking, oh, yeah, this could get a little spicy. But Esteban Ocon made a very cunning business decision. More on that in a bit.
It's absolute cinema.
It's like all of the anger and all of the frustration that has been building within Max over the last 5 or 6 months as Red Bull has fallen away. Rather than it coming out as Max becoming a silly bitch and overdoing it, it just came pouring out as sheer punishing pace.
If you ever saw the end of that, I mean, he was. There's a few major flashpoints that I want to address in this comeback. Number one, he was 11th by turn four. He cleaned up around the outside of three cars on turn three. It was like 2016 that happened again. He went around the outside of Nico Rosberg
at
turn three. It was the exact move, and he did it again. The confidence on lap one on cold tyres to be able to pull that off was insane. Charles Leclerc was the only guy who put up any kind of real resistance. That, if you actually go back to the team radio video that F1 puts out every weekend, they do this after every race where they put out a collection of the best radio messages. The peak of the rain, I think it was around lap 39 or so. There's a moment where it's a deluge. It really is borderline. It's borderline. I would have said this. If it was before the race had started, then we would not have started in those conditions. 100% no chance. We've had races suspended for less rain than what was on that track at that point in time, right? And Max is on the radio telling GP, his race engineer, it's really heavy, but hell, let's try a lap. And he stays out. It was Max's call to stay out in those conditions. GP backed him up and said, just be very careful. Three laps later, Quattrofinito's in the wall. His bravery's been rewarded because Norris and Russell, who were leading the race, both came in for a fresh pair of inters. There was fears amongst the teams that, generally speaking, the logic goes, if it rains heavier and you're on a used set of inters, the inters generally don't perform as well on a second sprinkle. So they wanted to be on fresh rubber. Apparently, Red Bull looked at Max's tyres and thought, no, they're actually pretty good. We're just going to keep going. It was survival mode out there, and his bravery was rewarded because after the safety car, he was second on the road. And once he got out in front, 7 tenths a lap, 8 tenths a lap, easily on the whole field. He set 17 different fastest laps in this race.
And by nine fastest laps would have all been the fastest lap of the race.
Fastest lap was over a second clear of the next driver's fastest lap. Lando Norris with the 10th fastest lap. It was an unholy clobbering.
It was a beating for the ages. It was a burst beating that Man City took last night. It was an absolute shellacking.
It was Michael Schumacher at Spa 1995, the y'all are not me drive. Because,
yeah,
I mean, he drilled Lewis on the second lap like he wasn't even there. And Lewis Hamilton, unfortunately, going out sad at Mercedes at this rate. Every car he caught up to Charles Leclerc, I mean, he went around them and just took off.
Yeah. It's they weren't even there. They might as well have been standing still. It was just the most I'm him kind of performance I've seen in modern F1 in quite some time. It was like a 2023 ass whipping all over again. It was like a war flashback for a lot of fans when they see the sirens in their heads when Max was just driving past them. Zabon, this was incredible.
Two or three more.
And that was tenths of a second rather than lap times, because that's just how dominant Max was.
Actually,
more or less.
Nuts. And like, given the context of where Red Bull has been, where they have improved, but they still clearly do have balance issues with the car, you've been able to tell watching that race, because it's 9 out of 10 times, Lando Norris is starting on pole. His main title rival is 15th, you know, after what happened before the official race start. You'd think he would have taken points out of Max, even if he doesn't win. No.
He lost 18. That's just
an entirely self-inflicted issue at mistake at turn one.
The first lap after that third safety car, where Max passes Ocon and 5 seconds later Lando Norris is off the road, will be the defining shot of this year's championship.
We got a wide shot of it, and we got his ass in 4K. If you want to symbolize 2024, it is Max getting away with it and Lando squandering what really could have been another race win.
Yeah, it could have been the race that got Norris a genuine title opportunity down this stretch. Instead, it turned into the race where Max Verstappen pretty much won his fourth straight championship. It's over. 63 points. We are with only three races to go. One of them is a sprint. So I make that 86 points left on the table. He's got a 63-point lead. We're just about done here. Like, Kota was the warning shot. Brazil was the one that went between the eyes. That's it. It's done. Yeah. And I know a lot of people have been very erratic on their perspectives on Lando Norris since this race weekend. And some of it has been very much below the belt. Once again, I don't know why we are sending these drivers death threats and putting way too much stock into racing drivers. Some of the language and discussions he's been completely unacceptable in every sense of the word.
I know what the foundation of sport is built on, but come on now.
It's ridiculous. However, Lando is not him yet. There's no getting around it. McLaren have been good enough to win so many more Grand Prix than the five they have won this year. And this was another golden opportunity for Norris to really counterpunch hard on Max in the title campaign, especially after being so good in Mexico. And he swung and he missed. He swung and missed harder than Aaron Judge in the World Series.
I mean, if you want to go by, when McLaren ascended to this position, not necessarily of having a dominant car, because that has been a very fluid situation this year between all four of our front runners.
Even Mercedes.
Hey, remember when the W15 reeled off 3 out of 4 in the middle of the year? That seems like so long ago. That day.
Remember when Ferrari was odds on to win constructors and then Carlos Sainz Jr. touched the paint?
Well, he would have been better off touching grass. Look, McLaren have won 5 races this year. They have had a race win capable car since Imola. Now, you wouldn't give them every race win since then, but let's say we give them half, and they have had been more than fast enough to win half or more. Not only is the constructors completely done, the driver's championship is still on. Even this race, he started on pole. He blew it. He was second by turn one. Because Russell mugged him off the line.
He's now 1 for 10 in lap 2 leads after starting from pole.
So, Dre, where do you think McLaren got this all wrong in those opportunities where once the car was capable of winning races, where do you think this championship really took a downturn before this weekend?
I don't necessarily want to say it was a massive downturn, because the problem was by the time McLaren got good, they were already 50 points down in the Drivers' Championship. The problem was Norris has never been able to take huge chunks out of Verstappen's lead because, one, Max has been so good at maximizing, pardon the pun, whatever he can get in a race weekend with the car. Yeah. He's not had, like, how many outright bad weekends has Max had all year? Maybe
not
two.
Not many. Like, he is still, this is still a better barometer of, like, Max Verstappen is clearly the number one driver in this team, because, man, I need to reiterate a point I made last week. It is no longer fun being a Sergio Perez fan. But,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, but, like, it's one of those things where I think overall McLaren are a team that have come across as more naive when it comes to the idea of executing on a championship level. Like, they've had 5 wins this year, and they've been very good wins for the most part, but I think they could have easily had 5 more. You look at okay, Imola, you know, botched in Spain, because you've botched starts before, and you've had some narrow defeats. Canada was a winnable race if you executed a better and you didn't put Norris in early. Silverstone, you put Norris on the wrong tire because he insisted the medium was the way to go, and he got it wrong. Monza, you had your pants pulled down by Ferrari on strategy. Hungary, you messed around with team orders and looked like amateurs, even though you came home with a 1-2 finish. We ran
Ferrari over the fucking coals in 17 and 18.
So what I'm hearing is,
with nowhere near this level of car.
What I'm hearing is, Dre, is that McLaren made a lot of blunders in terms of their policy, refused to take strong stances, and that's why they lost this.
I think it's everything. I think it's
something like that. I see what you did there.
And now have to do some serious soul searching for the future.
I think it's everything. Like, Norris has been messy on track on and off. Piastri is either the greatest thing I've ever seen or complete agony. And he needs to find some more middle ground. Because, like, great performance in the sprint, had to give it up for the championship. And then in the race, he was cheeks until that final safety car restart. And then
he's a second year driver. He's brilliant, but he's not a finished article yet. And that's okay for now. The real expectation comes 2025, 2026.
And perhaps, look, the start of the season is what it is. McLaren did not have a competitive car until Miami. But the 5 or 6 races after that, where it was on a knife edge and Max made the difference more often than not, that's what put him in a position where any one big bad weekend from McLaren would have been a kill shot against them.
Yeah.
Clutching out Imola, clutching out Spain.
Yeah, there were tight wins that Max came out the better of. And like I said, Max has just not made very many errors this year. But for me, the only two outright bad Max weekends for me, well, maybe three, was Baku, Hungary, and to a lesser degree, Monza. Monza, I thought the car just wasn't. Mexico was bad. I don't think it would have made a huge difference either way, because I think he was so poor in this. Like, the Red Bull was so bad in the second half of that race, I think he loses to both Mercedes anyway. That, like, Magnussen was faster in the back end of that race in Mexico than Red Bull was. I think Max finishes in sixth, penalty or no penalty. I don't think it ultimately made a huge difference in the end. For me, you could call Max scrappy for that one, sure, because, yes, he went way too far in his driving conduct. There's not been many bad days that Max... There's not been very many open goals that Max has given Lando to truly punish him.
And conversely, on the other side, Lando keeps... He keeps leaving everyone else in the doorway on starts. It's not a coincidence he's 1 for 10 from pole this year, at leading by the end of the first lap. And that's just not sustainable. And beyond that, like, Max Verstappen does not need to be a silly bitch, because when he's a serious bitch, he can do things like this. McLaren will learn from this, but at the same time, next year is not guaranteed. Just ask Red Bull this year.
Red Bull is in play with Max alone. Ferrari will be in contention, because Ferrari are not far behind McLaren right now at all. On certain tracks, they're outright better right now. Like, I don't think it's a coincidence that Ferrari, now they've got their development back on track, has actually come alive in the back end of this season. That's a good sign for next year.
Fred Vasseur, the track was wet.
Yeah, like, Ferrari is in the ballpark again, where they should have been at the start of the year. Ferrari would be in contention for both championships right now if they didn't throw away the middle of this season and lost 4 months of development.
That's the problem. Like,
they would have been right in play.
Ferrari for next year is that McLaren is basically going to win this constructors off of understanding their car better than everyone else for enough of the season.
Mm.
And that's something that Ferrari hasn't done in 15 years.
Right.
That's something that Red Bull, for the first time in a long while, have not been able to do this year. But at the same time, McLaren next year are going to be under the gun of the aero testing restriction because they are almost certainly going to win this Constructors' Championship. Ferrari, a little bit less so. Red Bull's going to get some development time back. Whether they push more of it into 26, which would be the smart play, or they get one more for next year, because again, next year is not guaranteed. It's a very interesting situation created by this cost cap and the ATR, where even on current form, it's swinging update to update, failed update to failed update. McLaren needs to start, they need to stop starting seasons with a boat.
Yeah. Ultimately, what's done, and my overall point I was going to make to RJ is that overall, it's not been the team orders and the minor hiccups on track that has screwed McLaren. It has been the fact they didn't have a competitive car for the first five rounds of this championship. That's what's done them in. They left so many more points on the table in that early block. You got to remember, Norris was 52 points off the championship lead going into Miami the weekend that everybody thinks this title swung because of the Adrian Newey departure news that came out that weekend. He's minus 11 to Verstappen since then. And that was I want to say 15 rounds ago.
Yeah, with a car.
That's what's done him in.
And since that summer break, with the mere exception of Belgium, they've been quicker than Red Bull at most rounds. Not all, but most.
Pretty much. The vast majority.
To lose points in that span, to having not really gained all that many before this race, it's a collective failure on all fronts, other than, hey, you made a pretty good car.
It's something. And you know, they'll likely win the Constructors, and that is still an achievement worth celebrating. Do not get me wrong. That's a remarkable achievement for McLaren, and it's their first world championship in God, 16 years?
That is something. 2008 was the last time they won any championship, but in terms of the Constructors, you got to go back to 98, because remember, they would have won it hand over fist in 2007, but they came away with 0 points for entirely unrelated reasons.
Indeed. Something
about a photo copy.
It's still a remarkable accomplishment, but let's not, as motorsport fans, sit down and pretend like we actually care about the Constructors. We all know what everybody really wants to win.
This is a human form for sport, and the Drivers' Championship is number one above all. That's why the Drivers' Champion has the right to take the number one wherever they want. Keep it at their team, go to a good team, go to a bad team.
Maybe Aprilia. Go to Aprilia.
Now, we want to talk about some bad teams. I did not see this coming. Alpine got both its cars on the podium in Brazil with Esteban Ocon finishing second and Pierre Gasly in third. Remember, three cars at the head of the queue decided, we're going to stay out until they red flag this. Esteban Ocon and Pierre Gasly were the other two besides Max Verstappen. Mm-hmm. You combine that with Pierre Gasly's seventh place finish in the sprint, it meant that Alpine scored 35 points on the weekend and leapt from ninth to sixth in the Constructors' Championship on one race alone with three races left. I know this is a big outlier in terms of Alpine's form, but man, there are a lot of people from Enstone Aviri that I got to be feeling really, really good. And it's about damn time, because Lord knows they've needed it.
First,
me and Cam,
for Team Enstone.
First on podiums
since my beloved Lotus E21 back in 2013 at Korea.
First time we had two French drivers on the podium since 1997. It's been a long time for the French to have something to genuinely celebrate. And
we went back, Dre, right? Because it was us, it was myself, Sasha, and JB, all going back through the annals of F1 history, trying to find a worse car that's double podium. And
I mean, this car has been pretty
this
bad.
This thing has been a pile of junk all year.
Yeah, it's been rough.
How?
Yeah.
How did that?
By having great pace when it mattered most, when the rain came down, and immense bollocks by sticking it out when the track was virtually undrivable. They were rewarded for their bravery. And hell, even when Max got away, relative to the rest of the field, their pace was great. Ocon was a comfortable second, and Gasly was comfortably able to hold off George Russell behind him, and he nursed that car all the way back home, and Alpine were legitimately the second or third fastest team in wet conditions. This was not a fluke. When the rain came down, they were fast, and I joked about it on our DRR post. Isn't it ironic that the car that's handled like a boat all year suddenly got competitive the moment the rain came down?
That car is so soft and squishy that it's perfect for the wet conditions, which is crazy. Well,
you see, missing 35 horsepower means that it's much easier to get that power down in wet conditions. That's how it works. This is, first of all, for a team that has been objectively awful this year relative to their expectations as a works team, insane amount of turnover within the team and management. That's got to feel real good.
Yeah. A salute to every single one of the ground staff at Enstone and at Veery who have had to have gone to hell and back over the news that the future of their power unit, powertrain department is very much in the air. It can't be good of seeing your team down the standings, your job future hanging by a thread. It's not been a nice time to be a part of Team Enstone this year. This had to have felt like some degree of relief. I saw the team celebrate now and there. They were jumping up and down in each other's arms like they just won the world championship.
Pierre Gasly and Esteban Ocon, who we know have this whole thing of they've hated each other since they were children, embrace one another as they've gotten apart for May to celebrate with their teams, man. This was a healing moment. And by the way, for all the shit that this team has had to go through this year, I said it all along, it is not the fault of these drivers. To previous Grand Prix winners, and look, we can say whether or not they won those entirely on merit and pace alone.
Can I actually say,
are Grand Prix winners.
Is there a more sneaky multi-podium guy than Esteban Ocon? He's got a few of these now.
Has there been a better driver in wet? Is Esteban Ocon a top three wet driver on the grid? Because every time the rain comes down, he's exceptional.
Right. Before that stoppage, he was actually pulling away from Max. He had more confidence when the rain came bucketing down. He was pulling away at the lead.
Yeah. I said it in the summer, like after Monaco, Esteban Ocon turned into the most overhated driver relative to what he actually is. And what an exclamation point to prove all those people wrong. And Pierre Gasly, you know what? He did pretty damn good, too. I gotta say that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was the proof that there is no substitute for a great driver lineup. Because when the rain comes down, when it's put in the hands of the driver and they can deliver, like, it can be priceless on weekends like this. And it was the driving quality of this Alpine squad that brought them home 35 points this weekend. Now, if you look at the scoreboard right now, it's tight. They've got a 2-point lead on Haas. They have a 5-point lead on RB with 3 races to go. On paper, I think Haas are probably favorites to finish in 6th by the time it's all said. I think they're a little bit stronger in the dry than Alpine right now. But if they can hold on to P6, and there's not many races left, who knows? They can score points in the dry on a good weekend, Alpine. It's not unthinkable. If they can hold on to that, that's a $30 million payday this weekend, because it's roughly $10 million per constructor's finishing position. This weekend might have been worth $30 million to Alpine. That's huge.
Yeah, that's really big. And again, we said enough times, what a performance from everybody. Again, big outlier, but That's a $30 million outlier and a huge morale boost for everybody at that organization.
If we had a Flacco 811 post for this race before Max Verstappen self-zoom ins, and then what the hell are two polar bears doing in Arlington, Texas? Why are they wearing blue and pink?
Now, you got to turn like Pierre Gasly into Schumi at Barcelona 96, and then you got to turn Ocon into like Jensen Button at Canada 2011. I don't know, man.
Nico Hülkenberg into Blood is Lost.
Oh, brother. Should we talk about some more bad policy?
Very relevant in this day and age.
Oh, yes. We mentioned that there was like biblical rain. We got some big flashpoints, potentially complicated decisions from race control, including two questionably late safety car drops, one for Nico Hülkenberg in the sprint and one for Lance Stroll's crash in qualifying. We also had a fine for Mercedes for adjusting their tire pressures on the grid. And Lando Norris and George Russell only got reprimands despite leaving the grid on an aborted start before they were queued up to. And all this while Oliver Bearman got like a 10 second time penalty for running into another car and spinning himself out. But man, the Lance Stroll crash in qualifying and the timing of it. Is that where we got to start here?
Personally, I think Lance Stroll should have been disqualified from having to see him again for his aborted start off.
Yeah, like this, as Mike in our chat quite rightly puts, it wasn't even the his worst moment of the weekend. It was all rough. But for me personally, RJ, I think the Hülkenberg stoppage in the sprint was for me the most egregious.
Really?
Hülkenberg's car is dead. Feet off the racing line coming down the hill towards Jinkau, and it's an entire lap before the VSC is deployed. And in that time, Nico Hülkenberg has been able to unfasten himself and jump out of his car with only a local yellow in that zone. That's unacceptable. That is incredibly dangerous. Like, there were cars going by at nearly full racing speed as Hülkenberg was climbing out of his car.
Didn't this also happen with Hülkenberg at the Grand Prix when he went off? And he eventually got disqualified for getting assistance, getting back onto the track. But wasn't
the Hamilton rule
stranded out in the runoff as the cars were coming around before they threw a VSC
in the Grand Prix? He was stuck on a drain.
It's kind of banked. Off the track.
Yeah, right? it was a banked beach. He was stuck in a storm drain, and the marshals, who Hülkenberg described as, quote, having a party before freeing his car loose, he was then disqualified because of the old Hamilton Nürburgring 07 rule. You are not allowed to receive outside assistance to return to the racetrack. First black flag in an F1 race in 17 years, as you do. We don't get those very often. In Formula One, is there a unicorn? No, for me, the Stroll one, there is a degree of mitigation in qualifying. And the reason why I say this is because Stroll was making a genuine effort to try and recover the car. That I can understand. The problem I have with that is that as the FIA, you've discouraged this from happening. Remember Canada earlier this year?
When Perez was shedding bits of bodywork everywhere?
Yeah, he crashes in the outside wall, loses his rear wing, his body was discombobulating all over the track, and Red Bull intentionally leaves Perez out and tells him to return to pit lane because they didn't want to pull out a safety car because they wanted to help Verstappen win the race. Red Bull was called to the stewards. Sergio Perez took a free place grid penalty, and Red Bull was fined €25,000. That's a pretty significant cash fine by the FIA. €25,000 fine for basically driving a car in a dangerous condition.
Great.
So you've actively discouraged drivers from taking damaged cars back to pit lane, and yet you didn't throw a red for Stroll trying to do the same thing.
And then later this weekend, when Sainz crashes in the race, he's able to get the car going, tries to bring it back, and they park him because they were already getting some of the recovery equipment through the roll hoop on his car. In the same weekend.
What are we doing here? What is Niels Wittich doing?
Your
race director.
Immediately.
Eduardo Freitas got fired for less than what happened during this weekend with Wittich.
Yeah.
And I do not like what happened with Gasly and the tractor situation in 2020. That was a horrible situation, and it was ultimately avoidable. But Wittich has a lot to answer for this weekend, because I think he fundamentally got it wrong on multiple occasions.
And it wasn't even the biggest penalty controversy in all of racing this weekend. Remember once upon a time when we talked about the 2021 Abu Dhabi Grand Prix?
Oh, it's never been mentioned.
Where I made the point, F1 didn't rule in favor of one driver or the other. They ruled in favor of entertainment. Couple of these kind of felt like entertainment calls.
It did. There is no justification, in my opinion, for Hulkenberg's VSC taking as long as it was to be deployed. And just so conveniently ending right before a DRS zone on the final lap of the sprint. The same. And look, I don't want to go tinfoil. I generally try to say, and what RJ has often said in the past, do not attribute to malice what could be put down to incompetence. A couple of these were sketchy. They were straight out of the book of IndyCar. The idea of delaying cautions for strategic and entertainment purposes, where the leaders can choose whether they want to stop or not before they drop the caution. And I've been very vocal in my displeasure about this rule for some time.
It's in qualifying, a bunch of people trying to justify it as you let people who are on laps try to finish their laps. Stroll wasn't getting that car back. It's straight out of the IndyCar playbook, as you said. It's let them complete what they need to complete and then freeze the session. And
I don't like it. I don't, because it's been a general pattern for the last two or three years in F1 where they've just delayed putting out cautions or putting out yellows. I don't like this, the trend that it's going towards. Mm-hmm. It's needlessly dangerous.
Look, man. The whole point about We Fit stewarding, when I made that sarcastic remark 3 years ago, is the fact that, like, you know, race directors are more incentivized to make these entertainment-driven moves more often than not now. That is how we are conditioned.
I don't like it. I don't like what Wittich is doing with that. I think it's nonsense, and I think it's completely unnecessary. And, like, the post-race penalties, Mercedes got very lucky reading the stewards' report. The fact that, for those who don't know, they were fined €5,000 for adjusting the tire pressure on the tires after they've been attached to the car. You're not allowed to do that, and you're not allowed to do it within 10 minutes of the start. That's what the 10-minute warning is for. You're not supposed to adjust tire pressures after the 10-minute warning before the race starts, or in this case, the restart. The problem I have with this is that there was so much mitigation in the report that it ended up only being a fine. I think they said something along the lines of the aborted start, the messed up race procedure, the aborted start, and the fact that gate access in the track was not opened on time all led to Mercedes only copping a $5,000 fine, because by letter of the law, they've broken a technical directive. That's normally a straight DQ.
The last time we had a Mercedes tire pressure controversy was, Monza 2015? And they threw the book at Lewis for that. They only ended up winning that race because they were able to pull it off of a gap. That's not the one I have issue with. The aborted start.
Mm-hmm.
What in the cinnamon toast fuck was that? All of it. the court of Sarn itself, the people who went with him, because then Lando becomes the control car. The way the F1 approached it, but doing two formation laps, the fact that after it gets investigated after the race, and it's a fine and a reprimand.
I don't like it because.
By the way, why did we have that second formation lap? Because Lance Stroll
is not a Formula
locked
driver.
Locked up going into a corner and then drove at turn four and went straight into the gravel trying to recover the car.
Hang on. That's not what happened. He nosed it into the wall, got it in reverse, got it straightened up, and then thought, that gravel looks safe to travel through. Instead of all of the pavement that he could have taken to get back on the racing surface.
He had the entire escape road available to him, and instead he chose to drive across the wet gravel and beached himself. His race was over before it even started.
Well, it could be worse. There could be a crowd of home fans cheering for a reserve driver who happens to be from that home country who's also on Stroll's payroll.
Dragovic.
I don't think it's possible for it to be worse than that. The only thing I can think of is that he nosed it into the wall, took a couple deep breaths, and thought, I can't do it today. I'm just not dealing with it today.
That is objectively one of the most embarrassing gaffes I have ever seen on an F1 circuit. I can't think of one right now that's openly more humiliating than that one. That is so bad. That is a complete brain fade.
I mean,
It's all time bad.
I don't know if it's up there with Taki Inoue getting clattered by the medical car, but it is up there. But yeah, that's why we had a second formation lap, and that is why that whole mess with the second formation lap is so weird.
Anytime you bring that incident in for comparison, you know how deep down the rabbit hole we are at. It's the fact for me, right? That the lights go out, the aborted start, Lando goes, few cars follow him because he effectively becomes the control car and the other people don't know any better.
Yeah.
And so that was considered in the stewards report, other than Russell, who caught the same fine and reprimand because he was on the front row. The red light is the red light. We saw F1 throw the damn book at Lewis in Monza, was it 2020, when he entered a closed pit. And the reason being that with those red lights on, in that situation, the track is not declared safe. There are people on the track. The track is not declared a racing surface in that moment.
Right. How do we know that they're locked? That's the thing that gets me about this. This could have been so dangerous. We don't know relative where Lance Stroll is on track. There could be a recovery vehicle on the track. There could be people on the track helping to recover his car. Mm-hmm. We don't know what that situation is when Lando guns the throttle, leaving his grid box, thinking it's another formation lap. It is so unnecessary and massively dangerous. You've compromised the safety of the race. You are held on an aborted start for a reason. Is to not put you out. Is not to put the cars out there. And it's dangerous.
Jason raised a very great point in our chat. The last black flag was for people leaving the pit lane on a red light.
Yeah,
right.
Canada, 2007.
So the stewards report that there were no mitigating circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
That it is entirely on Lando, and that it affected multiple other drivers.
Yes, because the RBs, and I believe it was. It was Esteban Ocon that were also brought to the stewards about this, but they were given no further action because they had a mitigating factor. You followed the leaders.
How was this on, given past precedent for releasing the cars onto the track when the track is declared, in this case, a red? How is this only a fine and a reprimand?
It should be a 10-second stop and go.
Lewis got during the closed pit lane in 2020.
But you know, a 10-second stop and go for Lando Norris does not benefit the World Drivers' Championship.
It's a 10-second stop and go. You convert it into a 30-second time penalty after the race, like Nikita Mazepin did when he was in F1. Because I remember in Austria, he copped a 30-second time penalty because he was going at full speed through double wave the yellows. That's the level of penalty I think this warrants, because you've broken a safety procedure. That's big. That is dangerous. That is something that you deserve to have the book thrown at you for. That was silly driving. That's poor knowledge from Lando Norris. You failed to read the book on this one, because as Max quite rightly pointed out in the radio messages in the video on YouTube about this, he did the right thing. He stayed in his grip box. He's had pole positions. He's had pole positions enough times where he knows the procedure. You don't go on an aborted start. You are trying to hold position.
I thought Max broke a gearbox because his car was...
He
basically pulled the car out of drive and the car wasn't moving. I'm just like, oh, this is a big day in the world championship. And then he dumps the clutch, gets it in gear and starts moving. I can't think of a situation more deserving of a procedural penalty than going on an aborted start.
That's bad, man. That's real bad.
Because you've also
influenced other cars behind you to go with you.
You've caused the whole,
so dangerous.
The whole grid to do an extra lap due to a procedural screw-up that had no mitigating circumstances.
And that's why the race got reduced to 69 laps instead of the original 71. They had to correct themselves later on in the race actually running, because they had to work out, hang on, we've done two formation laps. We've got to knock this down from 71 to 69 laps. The procedural error had a genuine effect on the race. It took an extra lap off the running. Like bare minimum, it should have been 10 seconds like Hulkenberg got when he parked in the wrong box at Qatar a couple of years ago. Bare minimum. This, a fine and a reprimand is nonsense. You've broken a safety procedure. That's the precedent we're setting for that now? Going on an aborted start? Are you crazy? That's so unnecessary. Mm-mm. Wittich has got a lot to answer for this weekend. He was piss poor as race director this weekend. Awful. Horrible.
You know what the best part is? Thank God we don't cover NASCAR on this podcast.
Oh, boy.
Like this, plus malice, plus manufacturer orders times 10.
I don't even know where to go there.
We'll unpack that at some point. Probably on the Golden Cock nominations this year. That's how serious I am. Quite possible.
Quite possibly. One more bit of news that dropped today. Great timing at all. Gabriel Bernaletto, Formula 2 championship leader, last year's Formula 3 champion, has been confirmed at Sauber for 2025, joining Nico Hülkenberg in that team. And it means that both Zhou Guan Yu and Valtteri Bottas will leave at the end of the season. Thoughts, gentlemen?
Tough one, this. It says a lot about the state of Formula One, in my opinion, and the culture of what's happened. We went into 2024 with the first time in F1 history that the entire grid had been retained. Like, there was no off-season driver switch for the first time in history. I had the general conclusion that, you know, it's great having these rookie tests and all that, but none of you were getting an F1 seat, so what's the point? And then Lewis Hamilton happened in February, and I think a part of it has been the hype around Kimi Antonelli, Ollie Bearman, who was fantastic in his Ferrari debut. Liam Lawson was great in his cameo role last year. He's been very solid in his cameo again this year. I think we've seen a resurgence of people taking chances on younger drivers again. Because as it stands now, We're going to have four full-time rookies in Formula One next year, and Liam Lawson, who's only not a rookie on the account of two part-time stints, is almost certainly going to be on the grid next year as well, with Doohan, Behrman, Antonelli, and now Bortoletto. And Bortoletto, I feel a bit bad for him to a degree, because if someone's about to do the F3, F2 double, which for a first-year driver has only been done three times in history, you know, we're talking Oscar Piastri, George Russell, and Charles Leclerc. Why weren't we dropping our pants down at Bortoletto? Like, did we lose some of the recipes here because we all knew Antonelli and Behrman was already going up, so the whole thing just kind of fell a little bit flat this year? Was that
you
it?
You can find that, plus the feeling that, like, well, if all the Mechachrome quality control is this bad, how do we know what to trust? But the thing is, I generally get the impression that if you run those two series back-to-back in your first year, you got to be at least a little bit good. You're not a freaking Rafael Philip Gomez or Amari Cordiel or Niels Kuhlin type driver.
That's Indy Next driver Niels Kuhlin to you with Chip Ganassi Racing next year.
Booking.com. Booking.yeah. Anyway, I think Bortoletto's a good hire. Like, I obviously feel for Valtteri Bottas because this is the end of his F1 driving career. It stinks because he's a multi-time Formula One Grand Prix winner, part of that Mercedes team. And I know we didn't really appreciate how good he was in that setup until the era of Verstappen and Perez and how those two matched up. But he never took himself too seriously at the end of his career. But, like, he did in a way that was different from Kimi Raikkonen, who always felt very antisocial and standoffish. He just wanted to do his drive. Valtteri, I think, was more personable, and I think losing a guy like that is going to stink. Maybe he sticks around as a reserve driver. Hopefully, he has a future racing somewhere else competitively. For sure, I'm sad this didn't work out. It's been 3 years, and this was the worst time to have his worst year in Formula One.
There's a lot of T20 qualifying performances this year for Zhou, and that just ain't going to cut it with what Audi is trying to be with this team. And don't get me wrong, I can't wait for Bortoletto to be completely unbenchmarkable next year in that brick of a Sauber.
Cam, the team formerly known as the Oakland Athletics are trying to punt harder on these next few years until their Las Vegas stadium comes in, then kick Sauber is kicking the can down the road until Audi steps in.
Yeah, they could build a great. They could have 300 horsepower on the field. If it goes into a chassis of this quality, it won't make much of a difference for them.
I swear to God, they're openly tanking for wins all the time.
Well, what I will say
here is, maybe that's why Red Bull keeps Sergio Perez around.
Trust the process and all.
Mm-hmm. No, I was going to say is that on any level, Valtteri Bottas has had an outstanding career. He's a first ballot F1 Hall of very good at double digit wins, 20 pole positions, 57 podium finishes. That's an exceptional career. In world championship runner-up in the past as well. That's a great, great career in the context of Formula One. You're already in the top 1% of the top 1% in F1 history. You're an outstanding driver if you've had 10 wins in F1. You don't fluke that sort of shit. But you are a quality driver at your very best if you are able to do that. And unfortunately, I think he caught a lot of shit because he had the unfair expectation of being compared to arguably the greatest F1 driver that's ever walked this earth. And that's not a fair fight for Valtteri Bottas, but he had to deal with it anyway. And
not to mention the guy he replaced.
Yeah, it was Nico Rosberg.
There was a lot of that, I think, was a product of what we thought Rosberg was as a community. Before we realized how good Rosberg was up against Lewis those 3 years of the turbo hybrid era.
It was buyer's remorse because we didn't think Rosberg was shit until he won. He said he won in 2016 and then we realized, hang on a minute, the man's got 22 career wins and actually ran Lewis pretty close in three of those four seasons they were teammates. And that probably was unfair on Valtteri because we were probably, as an audience, not going to make that same mistake twice when it came to misrepresenting what someone could do against Lewis Hamilton in his prime years. It was never a fair fight. And on a personal level, I have a lot of time and respect for Valtteri Bottas. This is a man who has been very open and extremely honest about his struggles, about his mental health. At one point, he openly admitted he was considering retiring because he felt like he could never beat Lewis in a fair fight over a full season. He's been very honest about going through eating disorders because of the nature of trying to stay super fit in the race car and, you know, the damage he was doing to his body by starving himself, again, for every competitive gain he could get. And as his career has developed and matured, he's become one of the most well-liked and well-received drivers in the paddock for just not taking himself too seriously, letting his hair down and going and being the anti-Kimi, a Finn who is actually personable, likable, genuine, and just fun. Like, what happened to the fun in this sport? We don't get a lot of drivers that are like that anymore. Someone who's just fun.
We had another one of those dudes step away earlier this year in Daniel Ricciardo. Like, this whole generation is stepping away pretty soon and will be gone before you knew it. Because Lewis Hamilton, Fernando Alonso can't race forever. Nico Hülkenberg can't race forever.
Because we're in a sport where fun is deemed as a weakness. It is deemed that if you're a fun-loving guy, you're not a serious racing driver. And I've always thought that was bullshit. That doesn't add up to me. Are we so dismissive of human nature that we think that human beings can't separate themselves when they're outside of a car and from when the helmet and the visor goes down? Because as a sport, we're okay with Johnny Herbert being a steward until he ends up giving away his opinions about it on a sportsbook's platform for money, but everyone's all suddenly okay with that because according to Johnny himself, I can be a pundit and I can leave that at home when I become a race steward. So why can't we do that with a driver? Did I say that out loud about Johnny Herbert? Whoops, my bad. Can anyone say conflict of interest? Anyway,
our sport's full of them. I know. We don't know what to tell you at this point. And the point about drivers who are just like not as robotic as we like to believe them, man. Zhou Guan Yu always got so much shit from the moment he stepped in.
I've always felt bad for him.
Yeah. I think he's a genuinely fun presence, and I can remember being like the only person in post-session media scrums that actually go out and like try to like get questions and answers from him and such. Because he's the first F1 driver from China, people just think he was created in a CCP lab with no personality or any like charisma about him whatsoever. Like, did his F1 career pan out the way it arguably should have, even in the most optimistic scenarios? Of course not. He'll go down as like a career back marker. His only noteworthy point is that he's the first Chinese driver to enter a Formula One Grand Prix. But I also think there's a lot more substance to him that people give him credit for. And I hope he's able to find another phase in his career where he could show more the driver that he was when he was in Formula Two, contending for weekends, winning every single weekend.
Mm-hmm. It's a shame. Again, we like to rag on Matt Marquez when it comes to F1 wheel knowledge and, you know, how good is a driver. Zhou Guan Yu never really got a fair shake with the F1 audience at large. I, to a degree, I get why he didn't have the most glistening junior record. You give these guys a punt, sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. It didn't work out in Zhou's case. I think he's a fine driver, and I think he'll be fine wherever he lands on his feet. Valtteri is, like I said, a first ballot F1 Hall of Famer.
Oh my God, you did the 10 out of 10 thing.
Ryan Eric King.
You win this round, King. You win this 10 round. Out
of 10, maybe. But yeah, I mean,
10 out of 10.
Let's also not pretend for either of these guys, which is that Sauber in their current situation are any kind of yardstick to measure someone by.
No, they're not a serious organization.
This unmitigated clusterfuck of a race, they still never look like they were scoring points.
Valtteri Bottas matched his best result of the year. He finished 13th.
23rd in the 20 driver championship. Gotta love it. Well, that's just about it from this weekend.
It is indeed. Yeah. Formula One's now got a 2-week break before the final set of triple headers. It's Las Vegas in just under 3 weeks' time. then the Grand Prix of Qatar, the final sprint rate weekend of the year over there, and then the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix on, I want to say, December the 8th to wrap up the championship this year. My God, we're in for a long one. Three more races, five more weeks to get through. As said, Max Verstappen can potentially clinch at Vegas in just under 3 weeks' time, a win. Or Lando Norris can't outscore him. I've one of those things happens. I've one of those conditions are met. Verstappen leaves Vegas a four-time world champion. We'll have to wait and see if that plays. I actually don't think it will happen this weekend. I think it will be in Qatar when the run rate goes up to stupid numbers. Before I think he'll wrap it up in. It'll be ironic if Max wraps it up the same way he did last year, the Qatar sprint race. I think there's a good chance that's where it happens, but we'll have to wait and see how that goes.
Wonderful anticlimax.
We'll be back. Speaking of wonderful anticlimaxes, next time on Motorsport 101, MotoGP's Malaysian Grand Prix, and hey, maybe the final Bozo Gene moment of 2024 that is maybe, quite likely, decided this championship. More on that very, very shortly. Until then, I've been Dre Harrison. They've been RJ O'Connell and Cameron Buckley. Please look after yourselves out there in this difficult time. We love you. Take care. Sayonara.
Later, y'all.
Well, at least it wasn't the fail melon.